on pop culture and politics. This is The Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth, a great day to confront a great and deeply perplexing question. How could it be that we live under such fortunate circumstances with standards of living that are unimaginable to previous generations of human beings? And yet, as Dr. Anna Lemke reports, despite increased access to all these feel-good drugs, we're more miserable than ever before. Rates of depression, anxiety, physical pain, and suicide are increasing, and not just due to the pandemic, but before the pandemic, they're increasing all over the world, especially in rich nations. According to the World Happiness Report, which ranks 156 countries by how happy their citizens perceive themselves to be, Americans reported being less happy in 2018 than they were in 2008. And that's before the pandemic, remember. Other wealthy countries saw similar decreases in self-reported happiness scores, including Belgium, Canada, Denmark, France, Japan, New Zealand, and Italy. The Global Burden of Disease study found the number of new cases of depression, and this is clinical depression, worldwide increased 50% in the 27 years between 1990 and 2017. Dr. Lemke is the author of a new book called Dopamine Nation. She is a professor of psychiatry and addiction medicine at Stanford, and she's actually medical director of the Addiction Medicine Dual Diagnosis Clinic. Dr. Lemke, thank you for joining us, and congratulations on the new book released yesterday, Dopamine Nation. First of all, maybe you can begin by explaining what dopamines are and why they're important.
Dopamine is a chemical, a molecule in our brain that is intimately associated with mediating reward, motivation, and pleasure.
So it sounds like it should be a good thing. People think the more pleasure, the better, the more fun we have, the better. Why is that sometimes dangerous?
Well, it is intrinsically a good thing because approaching pleasure and avoiding pain is what has kept us alive for many thousands of years. The problem is that we're now living in a world where everything has become drugified. We have infinite access to highly potent, highly reinforcing drugs. And the fundamental difference between drugs and behaviors that are addictive and those that are not is that substances and behaviors that are addictive release a lot more dopamine in our brain's reward pathway. And although the initial experience of that is to make us feel more good, the secondary effect is that our brain will then downregulate our own endogenous or innate production of dopamine and our own dopamine receptors in order to accommodate that huge bolus of dopamine from the addictive substance. So over time, we essentially go into a dopamine deficit state, which is akin to a clinical depression. And that's sadly happening not just on the individual level, but also as nations. We are seeing more and more people presenting with depression, anxiety, and yet these are individuals who have wonderful upbringings, access to privileged education, plenty of money to have anything they could ever want, and yet they can barely get out of bed in the morning.
What can we do about it, first of all? I mean, and this you write the entire book about. The book is posted up at our website at michaelmedved.com. It's called Dopamine Nation, and the subtitle is Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. How, first of all, do individuals begin to find that balance, and then how can we as a society do a better job of finding that balance?
As individuals, and also I think importantly as parents, We can first educate ourselves about the neuroscience of pleasure and pain, and I do that in the book using the extended metaphor of a balance so I can make it really clear to folks what happens to the brain with repeated exposure to highly reinforcing drugs and behaviors. And once we understand that and we can educate our children about that, then what we realize is we need to intentionally abstain from these substances for a period of time in order to reset our reward pathways so that we can take pleasure in more modest and natural rewards. And once we've reset our brain's reward pathway and we've achieved a new homeostasis, what neuroscientists call a level balance, then we can implement self-binding strategies. These are literal and metacognitive strategies to put barriers between ourselves and our drug of choice. And by the way, these are strategies that I did not mostly invent. These are strategies I learned from my patients. I'm a psychiatrist. I've spent the last 25 years treating people with addiction. People in recovery are modern-day prophets for the rest of us, because if they can figure out how to live in this crazy dopamine-saturated world, then the rest of us surely can. And so the book is full of helpful tips for how to create these barriers, these self-binding strategies, so that we can try to use in moderation. For example, if we leave enough time between use of high dopamine substances, then we can reset our reward pathway in between, and we won't fall into this vortex of compulsive overconsumption.
Okay, and you make clear that dopamine is not just generated by drugs or alcohol or marijuana or methamphetamines or cocaine or anything of that nature. It's generated also by video games. You write about that in the Wall Street Journal. It's generated by the addiction that some people have to their mobile phones and all the things you can do on the phone. Is it important to take a fast in that regard as well to help achieve that homeostasis you're talking about?
What I've learned through my research and my clinical work is that addiction to drugs and alcohol is no different fundamentally than addiction to video games or pornography or shopping or texting or tweeting or sugar or whatever it is. That fundamentally people start out using these drugs and behaviors to have fun or to solve a problem. But over time, with repeated use, our brains reset our reward pathway, ultimately making us less able to experience pleasure and more likely to experience pain. Hence, the intervention is the same. So, for example, as I write about in the Wall Street Journal, I had a young man who came to see me with debilitating depression and anxiety. He was also playing video games most of his waking hours. 20 years ago, the first thing I would have done was prescribe him an antidepressant or recommend psychotherapy. Instead, what I did was recommend a dopamine fast from all screens for a month. Now, this seems very counterintuitive. Why would I take away the one thing that was giving him some pleasure and relief? And what I told him was that my hypothesis was that the thing, the video games that he felt was the only thing he could enjoy, was actually the very thing that was making him feel bad in the first place. And by abstaining from all screens for a month, he would reset his dopamine and he would feel better. And he did it, and he did feel better. He felt better than he had in years, less depression, less anxiety, just by getting away from screens for a month. Now, I say just, but it's not an easy thing to do, right? He was socially cut off from friends. He was bored. I mean, it's really hard when we talk about a dopamine fast where I'm asking patients to do something really hard, but the long-term benefits are enormous.
That's also true of actually reading this fascinating, very well-written, by the way, book. It is called Dopamine Nation, subtitle Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. The author, Dr. Anna Lemke, psychiatrist at Stanford University. It's posted up at our website at michaelmedved.com. What about the addiction to argument that so many Americans have about, well, everything, including critical race theory? Any way to solve that? Find a middle ground? We'll get to that coming up on the MedVet Show. the Michael Medved Show, there are two gigantic and very bitter, almost hysterical controversies going on right now about American schools. At the moment, at least, the one that is getting the most attention is the least important one. The one that's getting the most important one is all about, are we going to have mask mandates for public schools, where basically teachers and students are going to be required to wear some kind of protective masking, at least for the next while we are combating, trying the explosive impact of the Delta variant and the pandemic. And that's one issue. And again, people are storming out of school board meetings, talking about various kinds of boycotts. A teacher got fired recently because of a refusal to wear a mask in the classroom. Now, all of that is going on, and it's extraordinarily heated, but everybody knows it's going to be resolved, right? I mean, for one thing, the mask wearing is not supposed to be permanent. It is supposed to help slow down the spread of the virus. And whether you support it as a strategy or you don't, you've got to recognize that unless things go horribly wrong with infectious diseases, 2 years from now, this is not going to be an issue. But I would imagine that 2 years from now, we will still have an issue over what's called critical race theory, which is also provoked a great deal of controversy, and I think for more reason. This is an issue that really changes the way that we look at our country. And it is extraordinarily important for people to understand that this is not an issue at its core about whether we are going to be teaching anything about America's past regarding slavery and Reconstruction and Jim Crow and the Civil Rights Movement. Of course we are. We already do. And particularly since the death of George Floyd, which has been a while ago now, it's getting on to a year and a half, there has been much more focus and much enhanced curriculum material on this issue. The question is, what is the message of that teaching going to be? And of all of the stuff that's been written on critical race theory, one of the most balanced and, I think, persuasive pieces was written by a school board official in Loudoun County, Virginia. He's out in Leesburg, Virginia. His name is John Beattie. And he basically explains that shouting matches, tears, and overwhelming frustration dominated the Loudoun County School Board's meeting on June 22nd. Sitting on the dais, I had a frontline view of the fundamental challenges facing our nation's education system. And it is a profound challenge, and it's not just in one county of Virginia. We're going to be talking about the critical race theory here in the state of Washington coming up. The critical race theory's proponents, writes John Beattie, claim America's entire social structure and fabric, you and me, our laws and our rules, are irredeemably racist and must be dismantled. And if somebody would like to challenge that definition of critical race theory, that's about as clear and comprehensible, it seems to me, a definition of what this theory teaches and what it's about as you can find. Again, he writes, critical race theory's proponents claim America's entire social structure and fabric, you and me, our laws and our rules, are irredeemably racist and must be dismantled. The Loudoun County public schools and school systems like it support CRT by recommending books and teaching resources. According to one strongly recommended book, White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo, quote, a positive white identity is an impossible goal. White identity is inherently racist. White people do not exist outside the system of white supremacy. In other words, any kind of acknowledgement that you are white, that you support what is called Western civilization, European civilization, that you are proud of the achievements of that civilization, that you support some of those achievements. You think that, frankly, some of those cultures, including our own, and including the British culture, the English culture that gave rise to American culture, that supporting that is inherently racist or white supremacist? Is that true? And he writes, this is a glimpse of what roughly 15,000 teachers are reading and using in their lesson plans for the estimated 85,000 students of Loudoun County, Virginia. But while outside groups tell the school board that our curriculum and district are racist and we must atone for this history, many surveys and studies have found that teachers don't want to talk about race in the classroom. A survey released last month by the Association of American Educators, a non-union trade group, found that less than half of members, actually it's 44.7%, favor critical race theory being even an option for educators, while only 11% believe that critical race theory should be required or mandated, which, of course, is what they were trying to do in Loudoun County and what they've been trying to do across the country, is to mandate it, require it, when basically only 11% of American teachers actually want that. Yet the National Education Association has vowed to push for mandatory CRT curricula in the classroom. And then he writes, if teachers and parents, the two most important groups in education, are uncomfortable with CRT, perhaps bureaucrats and elected officials should think seriously before proceeding. Parents also see the toxicity of CRT and don't want it in schools. Elected officials' obfuscation and inaction has driven frustrated parents to take charge through petitions to recall 6 of the 9 members of the Loudoun County School Board for supporting a mandated CRT curriculum. The idea that our schools should become indoctrination centers for something as controversial as critical race theory, for something as controversial as teaching our kids the belief that America didn't really begin in 1776 and it wasn't really based on the Declaration of Independence, it actually began in 1619 and it was based entirely on the 20 plus slaves who arrived at that time, and we don't even know exactly what day, who arrived in Jamestown, Virginia. This is an important perspective. If parents don't want it, and teachers don't want it, on what basis is it forced by politicians? We will get to that and more with the Washington Policy Center coming right up on the MedVet Show. Michael Medved Show. Sometimes people in the state of Washington, where I've been privileged to live for 25 years now, and and again, there are aspects of living in the state of Washington that get weirder and weirder and more far left and less in touch with sort of fundamental American values. But every once in a while, there are some developments, and very often those developments are put forward through the WPC, the Washington Policy Center, which is a center of mainstream American conservative, pro-market, pro-patriotic values in this state. Those values come through even on the issue of education. It's a pleasure to speak again to Liv Finn, who is the director of the Center for Education at the Washington Policy Center. So this issue that we were just talking about critical race theory, I know a lot of people, especially since people like Beverly D'Angelo are right here in Washington State, think that, oh, you can't fight this here in Washington, but every once in a while there's some indications that the public is not with critical race theory. What's the most recent indication, bit of encouraging news you have, Liv?
Well, I have seen three separate school districts in Washington state have written resolutions against critical race theory, saying that their students are not going to be taught that anyone is superior or inferior to another on the basis of race. That those are the Chehalis, Peninsula, and Moses Lake school districts. And there are many more weighing their options in the face of this mandate that was passed by Governor Inslee in the legislature this last spring, Senate Bill 5044, that put this divisive and harmful ideology in the schools, in the public schools. They did this.
Okay, and I know that people who would be defending critical race theory would say, well, this doesn't really say that any race is inferior or superior. It just says that one race is more guilty than another of oppression. And the answer to that would be?
Well, you're going to tell a five-year-old that they are responsible for let's just posit this idea in real terms. We're talking about children that they're going to be teaching that they are, their identities are based on their race, the color of their skin, something they could do nothing about, and that they're responsible for the for slaves 200 years ago in this country. I mean, how is that fair?
Well, it's
anyone?
Also saying that grandma and grandpa are responsible for all this terrible stuff.
Say again?
It's also saying that grandma and grandpa are responsible for all this terrible stuff.
Yes, and grandma and grandpa were probably fighting, you know, to get the Civil Rights Bill passed in 1964 to end the terrible Jim Crow laws that institutionalized racism in our country. We don't have institutionalized racism anymore. Remember, the whole civil rights movement did away with the notion that you can, that the government can use its power to hurt people based on the color of their skin. We don't have that in our country, regardless of what people like Robin DiAngelo say. She has no basis for these statements that she's making. It's an ideology that's based on this psychological manipulation. It is. I think it's very close to child abuse, and I expect to see lawsuits brought by personal injury attorneys suing the state of Washington, suing districts based on that.
Yeah, we have our share of personal injury attorneys. It's interesting they haven't turned to this yet, but the truth is it's better not to have the lawsuits and better to have sanity, allowing parents and even teachers, as we are just reading about, who do not support this radical notion of trying to teach kids about white privilege and teach people about guilt or innocence or positivity based upon race alone. Speaking of that, we were speaking yesterday about this tendency, which is sweeping our whole state, about land acknowledgments, beginning every class day, every work day in various places, saying, we are on the land of the Tongvan people or the Duwamish people, that basically that we are functioning on stolen land. Is that something that you're concerned about?
Yes, of course, because that too is a falsehood. I mean, we can't, it's again a manipulative device to make people feel guilty about their very existence. What happened in this country 200 or 300 years ago was not our responsibility today. That land was conquered, you know, with use of force, which was the way of the world then. And we're applying this current values to what happened in the past to make people in the present feel guilty about what happened in the past. And it's an effort to undermine the basic good feelings that people have about being Americans, okay, and how this nation is based on the notion of freedom and prosperity for all, regardless of where they come from. Look at the Afghanis that are trying to get into our country. Why are they trying to get to the United States?
And so, the fascinating thing is there was a huge poll with 11,000 people, and it was done by YouGov, and it was 2 weeks ago. And that poll asked people, do you think the United States is the greatest nation on earth? Do you know which ethnic division in America, which racial division in America, was most likely to say, yep, America is the greatest nation on earth, 73%? It was Native Americans.
Really?
Right? Yes, which is
very
shocking.
Interesting.
So, and there, by the way, is no meaningful difference. It's a 1% difference between whites and blacks. So all of this has to do with people whose motivation, it seems to me, wants to make children feel unlucky and unhappy to have been born into such a guilty, horrible, exploitative, oppressive country.
I think you couldn't say it any better than that. And when you think about it's being couched as trying to teach tolerance and diversity and acceptance, it's actually teaching children who come from minority backgrounds that they are oppressed, that they're somehow less than white children, and that this is a racist society that they've been born into, and therefore they cannot hope to get ahead in this world, which is a lie that is so pernicious and hateful. I can't understand how a teacher could stand in front of a classroom and promulgate this lie, because it undermines, remember, Michael, about teaching years ago, we were so concerned about the self-esteem of children and how to build them up and make them feel strong and self-confident and determined to, improve themselves and better themselves through what education can provide. Instead, we're telling them, you can't win, you can't get ahead, don't even bother to learn. It's so bad.
That's exactly right. And by the way, they found that sometimes when children had the highest self-esteem, that actually had a higher percentage of children with high self-esteem who got involved in criminal behavior, because they believed they were entitled to it. Look, one of the things, my wife and I did a book called Saving Childhood 20 years ago. And more than 20 years ago, actually, but to one of the premises there was, it's far more important to have people believe I live in a great country, I live in a great world, than I'm a great kid, because the one encourages a sense of entitlement, and the other encourages a sense of opportunity, which is what Washington Policy Center is all about. So glad you're there, and on top of this issue and many others. Check it out at our website at michaelmedved.com, Washington Policy Center. We'll be right back. Michael Medved Show, there are a lot of people in this country, I believe, who are profoundly overrated. I mean, just profoundly overrated. And one of the folks on the top of the list who seems to me completely overrated, and he was just honored in France, which is usually a sign. Remember Jerry Lewis was honored in France. They considered him to be one of the greatest comedians who ever lived. And look, I understand Jerry Lewis did some good charitable work, but if you look back on Jerry Lewis films, really, these are masterpieces. So being honored in France should not be the standard for anybody, and certainly not for Spike Lee. Spike Lee was just the senior juror at the Cannes Film Festival, where one of the big awards this year, we didn't cover it on air, was about a lady, well, actually a very beautiful lady, having sex with a car. not in a car, with a car. And the consequences that that brings. I mean, this is exactly what the world needs right now. In any event, one of the things the world doesn't need, and I should warn you on this, you're going to be on your own on this one because I'm not going to review it. It's an eight-hour-long documentary project on HBO by Spike Lee, and it's called NYC Epicenters, 9/11 to 2021 and a half. The documentary is described as an eight-hour-long collection of interviews that look at some of the similarities between 9/11 and the coronavirus pandemic. What similarities? Exactly. I mean, again, now, Spike is not saying that 9/11, is not saying that 9/11 and COVID-19 are both terror attacks. He's not taking that position. Why not? Because he doesn't think that 9/11 was a terror attack. The last episode in the series features interviews with 9/11 truthers from Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. At the very end of the piece, the interviewer, who is a New York Times pop culture reporter, asked Spike Lee about why he included them. This was about an interview about this forthcoming film. I'm not going to give 8 hours of my life to Spike Lee. I just won't. The last episode, this reporter asks, the last episode of the series devotes a lot of time to questioning how and why the towers fell. It's on tape. You can see it. They didn't fall because they were blown up by dynamite. Can you imagine how difficult that would be to coordinate? This is one of the dumbest things in the world. Is, in other words, if you believe, oh, actually, there was dynamite in the bottom of the towers, and but they made the dynamite go off at exactly the moment the plane crashed into the building. It's kind of tough to coordinate, wouldn't you think? How and why the towers fell. You interview several members of the conspiracy group, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, who are mostly not architects and not engineers and not sane. Why did you want to include their perspective? And Spike Lee said, because I still don't. I mean, I got questions. And I hope that maybe the legacy of this documentary is that Congress holds a hearing, a congressional hearing, about 9/11. Oh, they've never done that before. They didn't have a 9/11 commission that came out with extraordinarily good documentation about what happened and what went wrong with our intelligence and much more. And he says, you don't buy the official explanation, Spike? The amount of heat it takes to make steel melt, that temperature is not reached. And then the juxtaposition of the way Building 7 fell to the ground. When you put it next to other building collapses that were demolitions, it's like you're looking at the same thing. No, you're not. Before the building falls, if you look at the tape, if you look at the tape of Building 7, it's already leaning and tilting to one side because it was burning for several hours before it fell down. I mean, this is insane, basically. And it's very sad that people believe this. And this, by the way, this could actually be one real similarity between September 11th and the pandemic. Both are disasters. Both changed our worlds. Very few people would say either one changed our world for the better. But and both of them gave rise to completely lunatic conspiracy theories. And absurd stuff. Like, what, they're taking horse medicine now? People who believe that that's the right way, that's going to be a more effective way to deal with the pandemic than vaccines? He says, my approach is to put the information in the movie and let people decide for themselves. Okay, it's 20 years later. Don't you think most people have decided for themselves about September 11th? And then Spike says, right, but you don't say make up your own mind about whether or not the vaccine is poison, or make up your own mind about whether Joe Biden was legitimately elected. People are going to think what they think regardless, he says. I'm not dancing around your question. People are going to think what they think. People have called me a racist for do the right thing. People said in Mo Betta Blues I was anti-Semitic. She's Got to Have It. That was misogynistic. That was his first film. People are going to just think what they think. And you know what? I'm still here going on four decades of filmmaking. Okay, most of his filmmaking is not documentaries. There's a difference between making a documentary film and making a regular narrative live-action film. And the idea that Spike Lee, Oscar winner, and as somebody who has received all kinds of undeserved acclaim, and Michael Moore, same thing. I think some of his documentaries are kind of clever, but none of them are really Oscar-worthy, and none of them are reliable, and none of them come from an honest perspective. And on the same day, we have Spike Lee defending this forthcoming 8 hours of ordeal that is going to revisit, quote, the claims of 9/11 truthers. As we have Michael Moore coming up with a column that says, thankfully, America lost the war in Afghanistan. That's the opening of his column. How can any sane, decent American, thinking individual, say thankfully? Think it's thankful that we lost the war. To what? Who did we lose the war to? Because you don't lose the war to yourself. We lost the war to the Taliban, and it was a loss that we're still trying to cope with and to prevent all kinds of people by the thousands from being not just oppressed, but slaughtered. And Michael Moore thinks that's a reason for thankfulness. And again, for people very often on the left, if you talk to them about the way they characterize our country and what goes on in our country, you say, you know, you're anti-American. They say, no, no, we're not anti-American. We are pro-American. We want America to be as great as it should be, to be everything that it ought to be, that it'll live up to its highest ideals. Does it advance America living up to its highest ideals to lose the war in Afghanistan? I mean, of all the wars that we fought, you have to really go back a ways to find an enemy who is more clearly undeserving of support or sympathy or endorsement than the enemy of the Taliban in Afghanistan. And again, somehow one would think that a public figure like a Michael Moore would know enough to realize that it does not somehow aid his public image to say he's thankful about America's loss in the war. Speaking of winning and losing, a big plus coming up for the Republican cause in the California recall election. And a major endorsement, actually, by a leading prominent Democrat for Larry Elder. We will get to that story and to much more, including the very latest on the Biden administration's struggle to escape from this swampy disaster of the evacuation. That and more in this greatest nation on God's green earth.